Hello, everyone, all the farmers out there. This is Helen Dusser from Farming Secrets on our Talk the Walk 12. And online we have Dr. Elaine Ingham. Elaine, we welcome you to the call today.
Oh, thank you very much.
A pleasure. Now, Elaine, for those of you who are not familiar with her, she's the President and Director of Soul Food Web Institute, which was established late 1999 and has since established 8 to 10 laboratories around the world and several private ones. Now, Elaine, starting out as a nematologist, there's been quite a shift for you into the world wildlife of microbes. Could you tell us what caused that change for you, please?
Well, both of my degrees are in microbiology. My husband is the nematologist, and I know it's very confusing because when you go to the scientific papers, I'm E.I. Ingham, and my husband is R.E. Ingham. And people will often get us kind of confused because, especially in science, the initials were so close and everything. But no, I'm a microbiologist. My master's degree is in marine microbiology, and my PhD is in soil microbiology. It's my husband who has both of his degrees in nematology.
Look, Elaine, I apologize because I always understood that you met him as nematologist and then you branched out. So there we are.
Yeah, there we are. Well, yeah, I'm a microbiologist, and especially when I go from marine microbiology to soil microbiology, it was quite a shift because when you're dealing with aquatic systems, you don't have this little problem called soil that gets in the way of seeing things. So we didn't have the methods for looking at organisms and assessing really what was going on in soil. And that is what I did for my PhD work at Colorado State University, is worked out the methodology for being able to assess total and active bacteria, total and active fungi, protozoa, nematodes, all on the same sample material, and not have to take, you know, 2 weeks to a month to look at bacteria and then another increment of time to do fungi and some more time in a different sample to do all each organism group. We're basically looking at all of these organisms at the same time with the methodology that I developed for my PhD.
So you were in a laboratory doing all of this, and what actually got you to start out on your own?
There were a lot of growers that wanted to know about the biology in the soil, what was going on. For my husband's PhD research, he was looking at the question of how do available forms of nutrients like nitrogen, nitrate or ammonium or phosphate, how do they get made in soil? And so his PhD work was basically documenting that bacteria and fungi tie up nutrients. Bacteria and fungi don't release any nutrients. They can't. Their C to N ratio is too narrow. So any nitrogen available, those organisms are going to be taking that any inorganic nutrient up and tying it up in their biomass. And then what makes that nutrient available back to the plant is the bacterial feeders, for example, protozoa, or the bacterial feeding nematodes, earthworms, eating the bacteria, and when that predator-prey interaction happens, that's what releases plant-available nutrients from the bacteria. When fungi are eaten by their predators, fungal-feeding nematodes and fungal-feeding microarthropods, that's the release of the nutrients that are tied up in the fungi. That's how they're released in a plant-available form. We have to make certain that all of this is concentrated in the root system because you really don't want plant-available nutrients outside the root system. You want it just around the root. And Mother Nature has figured out a really great way to make certain that nutrient availability is pretty much concentrated in the root zone. And that's by the roots themselves putting out the cakes and cookies to feed the bacterium fungi, grow huge amounts of bacterium fungi in that root zone, of course, tying up nutrients, keeping them right there in the root zone, And then the protozoa and the nematodes and the microarthropods are attracted into the root zone. So right there is where 99% of the nutrient cycling in soil is actually happening. So it's a really nice, convenient way to, the Mother Nature's figured it out, if you will. It took human beings a long time to figure it out. It wasn't until the mid-1980s that we, that this was really worked out, and it's my husband's PhD work. It's the ecological monograph that he wrote in 1986 on nutrient cycling and the predator-prey interaction, how it affects plant uptake of nutrients. So it wasn't really until the mid-1980s that information came out in the scientific literature. And, of course, I was part of that. My husband and I have had some really interesting dinnertime conversations. And so a lot of that discussion, I did a great deal of the bacterial and fungal work that's reported in that paper. So I'm actually third author on that ecological monograph.
So you're saying the growers then came to you
mm-hmm.
because of these papers. They were aware that there was another way to approach adding things into the soil, but they heard about what you were doing and were curious. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically that with the publication of the ecological monograph, both my husband and I had given papers at various scientific meetings, you know, so the Ecological Society of America, the American Microbiological Society, the Soil Ecology Society, on a couple of papers. So the other people we were working with at Colorado State University were also writing papers. From Colorado State University, I went to the University of Georgia, where we documented this whole process in corn, soybean, sorghum rotation systems. And, you know, clearly it's a sustainable system. We aren't using toxic chemicals. We're reducing the amount of tillage. We're getting all these incredible benefits. And the plants grow better, and you're getting higher yield for a lot less cost of growing those plants. And so as that information has been received, growers, of course, are, well, they're not making a lot of money in the chemical system because everything's just so expensive. So here was an alternative. Here was a different approach. And especially when they want to do things in a non-toxic way, without those chemicals, without the cost, without the tillage or reduced tillage, this is the way to go about doing it.
Yes, you constantly talk about making it easy for the farmer. And many farmers are, in fact, starting to realize due to the climatic conditions and fertilizer prices going up, that are looking for different ways. And before we look at the questions that we've got here from our farmers, I'd like you to just talk about some of the projects and the diversity of farmers and growers who have successfully used compost and compost tea. And I actually would like you to start with the biggest operators first. So would you like to just go through some of the really successful projects and, because I'm sure our farmers would love to hear about them.
Yep. Well, I do like to point out that just within the United States alone, we work with over 2 million acres of agriculture. Now, that doesn't count landscape, that doesn't count greenhouses, that's just agriculture. So we work with every size grower. We work with people who have potted plants on their balcony and they have a garden, an acre, 40 acres, 100 acres, 1,000 acres, and some of the largest growers that we work with, for example, the work that we've been doing in Ukraine this past year, 50,000 hectares of land in cultivation, growing mostly grains but some vegetables and things like that, or the largest tomato grower on the planet that I'm aware of with 300,000 hectares. Not all of it is actually in agricultural production, but I think just the tomatoes alone average somewhere around 5,000 to 7,000 hectares of tomatoes that they're growing on an annual basis. So just a really large acreage people. whenever we approach any grower from any size property, we've got to get background on what they've been doing and what the problems are. And that helps us understand what we need to fix. It gives us a really good idea of the biology that they're having problems with, what's lacking in their soil. So there's got to be some initial testing. And then we're going to help that grower make some real compost, not waste reduction mulch stuff that you get from any of the municipal, I wouldn't really call them composting operations, but that's the label that we've put on them, that they're making, they're trying to get rid of waste material. So they're following a waste reduction process, which is not the process of making compost. We're trying to make certain that all of the proper sets of beneficial organisms are present in that organic matter. So we work with growers to make sure that they're making the sets of organisms that they need to be putting back into their soil. And you don't necessarily have to put out compost. That solid material can be very expensive to transport to a field and then spread. So quite often it's easier if you turn that compost material into a liquid. So you can be putting out compost extract if you're going straight onto the soil, especially large acreage. You can make a compost extract with proper sets of biology in it to fix the problems that you've got. You can typically make a compost extract in about 2 hours. Whereas if you've got to be going on to foliage, if you've got foliar fungal diseases or nutrient limitations, there's a fertility problem you need to fix right away. If you've got insect pests attacking the foliage, then you've got to make a tea, and the organisms have to actually stick to the surface. So now making certain that you're getting all the proper biology in there, quite often the first wave of colonization that you applied, all the organisms don't survive. It's kind of like, you know, the Europeans coming to the shore of Australia. The first set of colonists didn't live very long. The second wave lived longer, the third wave, and, you know, then you finally get things started to change and you take over the continent. So it's the same thing when we're dealing with these organisms going into any soil, especially one that has been hammered and destroyed, and there's huge compaction, lack of oxygen in the soil where we've got toxic chemical residues. So working with growers to fix that. So, for example, in the Ukraine, we started fall in November. Well, it was really more like August of 2 years ago, and got them going on making good compost, looking around for their own starting materials that were just there on property, getting the composting operation up and going. And, for example, Bill Avery helped us with this. So he was out there in Ukraine teaching people how to make proper compost and then turning that into a liquid form, putting that out on the land. I believe most of the property we managed to actually get the seeds of the grains coated, the vegetables coated with the proper sets of organisms. And then depending on, you know, exactly all of the problems that you can have with equipment breaking down and not having the help and things like that were happening. But most of the property got at least some amount of compost extract or compost tea out on the soil to some places where we got 3 applications. And the improvements in yields were just amazing, just incredible. Having proper monitoring of the improvements, we've got the data comparing the non-sustainable part of the operation, the conventional kind of system, with the biological sort of the system. On barley, for example, when you planted one seed of barley into the conventional system, you got one stalk of grain and one seed head. And on that seed head, they had, I think it was 30 seeds. And on average, 30 seeds were produced on one stalk. And there you are. That was the yield on the conventional side, where we put one application of the proper biology out instead of one stalk coming from one seed, we had three stalks, so the main stalk and two tillers. And each of those tillers also bore seeds, and instead of 30 seeds per head, we had 36 seeds per head. So right there, we've more than quadrupled yield with one application. Well, where we got three applications out, for example, instead of two tillers, we had somewhere between 5 to 6 tillers per original seed. And each of those tillers then had somewhere around 42 to 46 seeds per seed head. So ultimately, in those fields, we improved yields by 140%.
That's phenomenal.
And we didn't use pesticides. No, there were no weeds in these systems, so they didn't have to be putting out weedicides. They didn't have to be out there driving around trying to knock the weeds down. They didn't have to be applying any of the pesticides, inorganic fertilizers, not necessary. Very poor rainfall in this part of the Ukraine this summer, and most of the time the irrigation systems didn't work. People kept stealing the pipes, and that's what you have to deal with in that part of the world.
Elaine, just going back a bit with the Ukraine, haven't they tried other things? Didn't they approach other systems before they came to realizing that your one was the one that worked? Is that correct?
Yes, they'd been trying to do an organic approach for like 2 years before us, and they had just the failure was impressive. They were spending a lot of money and not getting any improvement in yields, and the weeds were just eating them alive. Because you're not allowed to use the typical herbicides in organic systems, basically you have to mow them or till them out when you're following an organic approach. And it was just the cost of the gasoline was just overwhelming for them, so not very successful. So and a lot of people who want to go organic and get the increase in yields, increase in prices that you can sometimes command. A lot of people are very interested in going organic, and so they really have to get the biological system established in those soils, or the weeds will just eat you alive in a organic system quite often.
Yeah. And so just getting back to this, the results with the Ukraine, those type of results, do you see them duplicated elsewhere? Like I know that you've got strawberry growers, or golf courses, all sorts of people. I mean, what the bottom line for these people is, getting that soil biology going, isn't it?
Right, and it's almost like every plant you want to talk about, we've dealt with people at all scales of resolution. So, grape vineyards where we work with, 20 to the operation that we're dealing with has somewhere in the order of 25 to 30 farms, each of which has, buku, acres of grapevines, and they're seeing the same sort of positive results where putting on the compost, making certain the compost has the biology, getting them into the soil, getting the proper biology on the vines prevents all of these kinds of problems. On the other hand, we've worked with grape growers in Australia, for example, where they haven't done any testing. They don't know that the compost, if the compost has got the biology in it, they don't know if the liquid they're producing from the compost has got any of the biology in there. And they just absolutely cannot assume that the biology has somehow magically arrived. You've got to do some solid testing to know that you're actually making good compost and that you're making good compost tea. Anybody who wants to just tell you, don't worry, how could this not be good tea? Look at how brown in color. We never solved any disease problem with brown water. We'll solve disease problems if we've got the appropriate biology in that water using the brown stuff as a food resource, but just because the water is brown does not tell you that that you've got what you need. And we work with potato growers throughout the western part of the United States. We work with potato growers in Ireland. We work with potato growers in England and, you know, whatever crop you want to talk about. So, for example, we work with over 400 golf courses in Europe through another company. There, the people are actually out there making the compost and the teas and getting them applied on these golf courses. But there, you know, over 400 of their clients are very happy with the results because we are seeing a shift from the not very friendly grasses to the more desirable grass species in the greens, on the putting, on the tees. You know, so we see the shift to the really nice uniform sward that all your, you know, paying members want to be putting on those surfaces because they roll really nice. They have just exactly the right response surface, no weeds. We don't have the insect pests. We don't have the root grubs. We, you know, so everything is, but you got to be monitoring the biology. So we work with pecan orchards. We work with pastures of all kinds all over the world, the largest tomato growers in the world, so all of it.
With the, you're saying you really it's essential to test the compost or the compost tea that's going out. Now, if someone has done your courses, has done the microcert course, they still would be advised to keep sending sampling in until they've got it right? And would it be advisable that they join the Soil Food Web Growers Program so that they can be assisted?
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea for them to have us put forward when they need to be applying the various kinds of materials. And we're always basing it on what's the last test that they did, and therefore what, you know, what sets of organisms do they still need to be improving, what needs to be fixed still. And then after, you know, a couple times of they do their own qualitative test, and at the same time they send the same sample into the laboratory, and they start to learn what their qualitative test actually means. After they've done that, you know, 3-4 times, they should start having the confidence that they know what they're actually measuring when they're doing their qualitative test. Now, some people, you know, they'll do their qualitative test and they keep running into organisms that they've never seen before. Well, until you really know what you're looking at, until you're confident of what you're doing, it's really telling you, you really understand what all the bacteria look like and you're getting that down. Well, you know, you're looking at different fungi, and you're getting that down. Protozoa, nematodes. So there's got to be a number of samples that still get sent into the lab so you do this comparison work. I know that, you know, if you really wanted to, you could probably set up some time with Merlene at the lab in Lismore, where you brought a bunch of your samples with you, with your microscope, and then you could be right there in the laboratory. You do those tests, they're doing the tests on the big microscope, and you can compare immediately right now and very rapidly learn exactly what are you looking at when you're using your small microscope.
Yeah. Now, that seems, yeah, there's a lot of excitement once people start learning what's under the microscope, and we've seen a lot of very excited students with you learning those skills and you know, really understanding the importance of knowing the balance of what they're brewing up, which takes me on to when you were here and our walk, the talk was about visiting three of your students, two on the Growers Program, Paul Casey and Rob Sutherland. The last ones, Peter and Michael Doyne. Michael had done your course and he went off to do the two-week course after we visited. The problem, a common problem between Paul and his blueberry and with Michael and Peter was compaction. Mm. This seems to be a major, major problem with a lot of farmers. And we have one question here, which I'll just read out to you. It is, oh, I've lost it. Our soil is rocky and full of onion grass and saffron thistles and compacted clay loam. We use it for grazing. Could you comment on compaction and on ways we could tackle it, please?
Yeah, the weedy species that he's talking about there are Mother Nature's way of trying to break up that compaction. It's going to, unfortunately, take those weedy species, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, maybe more, depending on a lot of environmental factors. And most of us don't have that time, really, to wait around for the natural system to rebuild soil structure and move on to the next stage of succession, which is the next stage of succession is more of our brassicas and early successional crop species in the United States. After that is the vegetables, and the stage after that is the row crops, the pastures come after that. And then after that, the next stage of succession is things like blueberries. So this particular grower's got how many ages of succession to go through till that soil would naturally have developed and built up to the place where it would normally, it would be naturally growing the blueberry. So our purpose is really to...
Are you still on the line? Could you not fiddle with phones because it's coming through and it's going to make it very difficult for people to hear land. So if you're near a phone, just don't handle it, please. Thank you.
So it's going to take quite some time for the natural system to build up the soil and to be able to grow blueberries without any of the problems. And what we really want to do is move that successional process along very rapidly. So with the compaction, probably the first thing you want to know is exactly where is the compaction in your soil, because then you know where you've got to be getting these organisms down to start that process of building. And especially if you've got compaction, you know, where we're down, you know, 15, 20 centimeters, maybe deeper, applying the biology at the surface of the soil and more or less crossing your fingers and hoping that the biology is going to move down to where the compaction is, you know, that's maybe hoping for a little much. Therefore, the very first thing we will probably do is to apply the biology on the soil surface to the surface of those weeds and then go ahead and fill that in. We might want to, if we've got time before you're trying to establish a perennial plant or before you're going to be putting in your row crop or broadacre crop or your pasture, if we've got time to go in with a fungal-dominated plant that's going to really start moving the biology in the system to the same, to the place that the blueberry, if that's what you want to grow, we try to get that moving to a fungal-dominated system by putting in a cover crop. For example, red clover, crimson clover, works very well in most of the temperate parts of the world. So that, you know, that's a possibility. Sometimes people don't have the time before they want to get planted. So the more times we could go in with a compost extract or a compost tea with really good fungal foods, if that's what's needed to push fungi really hard and get that whole food web properly balanced for the crop plant that you want to grow.
We're talking about the fungal dominance, and actually the question was for grazing, a pasture person, so if we could address the how you deal with it with pasture grazing and not the blueberry, that would be more applicable to this person's dilemma.
Okay, great. I thought it was blueberry, so thank you for correcting me.
No, that's okay.
So pasture. Because in a pasture system now, we don't want to go and till it up in any way, shape, or form. So when we're looking at this ratio of fungi to bacteria, we need to move the soil from the condition that the weedy species are trying to fix, and it's going to take some time for them to fix that. So they're very bacterial, almost no fungi at all. which is what is allowing those weedy species to outcompete everything else. Slowly with time, Mother Nature is going to put in more fungal foods and bacterial and move the soil so the weeds won't grow, but that next stage of succession will. So when we're dealing with pastures, we don't want the really early successional pasture species. We don't want Bermuda grass. We don't want cucuyo. We don't want some of the pasture grasses that people are being told are the only thing that grows here. Your soil is so poor. The only thing that's going to grow are these pretty early successional grasses, and there's just nothing you can do about it. No, no, no. That's really inappropriate to have those sorts of attitudes being perpetrated. What we need to know is that if we can just build that fungal biomass, get the ratio of fungi to bacteria correct, equal biomass of fungi to bacteria, get your fungi up to 300 micrograms per gram of soil, and get your bacteria at the same place, balanced, one-to-one, 300 micrograms of fungi, 300 micrograms of bacteria, or even better, you'll have more productive systems. 400 micrograms of fungi, 400 micrograms of bacteria. But the balance is really critical, too. So if we can be putting on extracts, moving the soil in this direction of balance, if we can be putting on teas, if we can be putting in fungal foods, if that's what's lacking, we got to grow that fungi more, we're going to put in fungal foods, get those fungi that we've inoculated with the compost or the compost tea, to start growing, ramifying throughout your soil, building structure so the root systems of the grasses can go down as deep as they can. If you've got compaction at 4 centimeters, 10 centimeters, 15 centimeters, your root systems cannot grow down into the soil. And when they're competing with weeds in the very shallow soil system, the weeds are going to win. The kinds of situations where, you know, many pasture agronomists talk about when the animals come in and graze the plants, the root systems slough off. That only happens if you've got badly compacted soil, your plants are really unhealthy, and they're right at the edge of death. Then when you graze, the roots do fall off. But if they're healthy plants, if the root systems are going down the 10, 15 feet, so what is that, 3 to 4 meters, as deep as they ought to be going, then we won't have roots being sloughed. We don't lose the root systems. Those plants regrow very rapidly, and there's not a weed on the planet that can compete with grasses that have their roots that deep. So we've got to get the biology down there.
That's the real key point. I think a lot of farmers, where I went to hear Gerhard the other day, and he was talking about root depth, and he showed them that profile of the roots, you know, the ones with all the ryegrass and clovers and things with the different root lengths. And someone said, but we never see roots like that. And Gerhard said, no, you don't, do you? You know, like... that is a very key point. But getting back to you talking about putting fungal foods and things into the soil, we're talking to farmers here. A lot of them are not familiar with soil food web work. What sort of foods are you talking about, and what sort of pasture, what would you be planting out to get that fungal growth?
Typically, we want to put out a compost extract or a compost tea that's made from a compost that has a lot of fungal biomass in it. In the compost itself, that means the compost has to have been made with a lot of woody kind of materials, a lot of stalks and stems, wood chips, paper, cardboard, wide carbon to nitrogen ratio containing materials. And those are all fungal foods. So, you know, there are some products that you can buy, for example, humic acids or fish hydrolysate, because all the oil in the fish hydrolysate are very wide seed-in ratio materials, very difficult for any bacterium to decompose, and so you're selecting for the fungi. What a lot of people aren't aware is there's not a lot of regulation on the term fish hydrolysate or fish emulsion. And so we've got a lot of snake oil salesmen out there selling materials that they're calling whatever it is they think the grower wants to buy. And so it's not really a fish hydrolysate. To make a fish hydrolysate, all you're doing is basically taking a fish and throwing it in a wearing blender and blending it up. So all of the oils, all of the nice wide proteins, the shell, the fish scales, the cartilage, all of that is just blended into a nice micronized puree, if you will. And that's basically what we're applying. As soon as you apply heat of any kind to that finely ground slurry of fish material, the oils will start separating. And so if you've bought something that somebody called fish hydrolysate and you open it up and you can see a layer of oil on the top of that material, it's not a fish hydrolysate anymore. There's your oil sitting on the surface, and so it's been heated in some way, shape, or form, or it got too hot sitting in the container on the shipping to you. It got too hot, and so the oils are separating off. And you either have to mix those oils in or put the oil on. That's a good fungal food, but the rest of it is probably going to be more bacterial food. So we have to be careful with some of these. When we deal with a lot of
I think you do need to be aware, because we used to manufacture and wholesale fish fertilizer, and I know that some companies separate the oil out. A lot will heat up the fish to a degree that they'll get a higher, is it a propane rating, Hugo?
No, that's...
Oh, look, it doesn't matter anyway. But, I mean, you do need to know exactly what you're buying. As you're saying with your compost as well, you need to know what you need for your soil, so it's not quite as simple as just saying, oh, well, I'll go and get some compost or whatever. You actually do need to ask how it's made and all the questions. Well, you need to know the questions to ask as well. So I think that's a very good point that you have raised. Well, look, going on, we've got some more questions. Some have been covered already with what you've said. Hugo is going to take over asking you some questions, Elaine. From our farmers. So the first one here goes from David, is that right?
Yep. Elaine, the question is, does timely cultivation for weed control damage biology in the soil? That's the first question. The second question, I might as well ask you both together, are herbicides used for summer weed control more harmful to the soil than cultivation?
The standard ecological answer works for both of those. It's called, it depends. When we're talking about cultivation, is it damaging to the biology in the soil? It depends on what kind of cultivation we're talking about. If you're going in with a single mold board plowing event where you're basically taking the material that was at 10 centimeters, flipping it over, so what was at 10 centimeters is now at the surface of the soil. What was at the surface of the soil is now down at 10 centimeters. And you haven't tilled any more than that for the last year. No, we probably can't even detect an effect of that kind of tillage on the organisms in the soil. It's not enough of a disturbance. But if you go the other end of the spectrum and you go and you rototill your soil, not are you only imposing a compaction layer at the depths that the rototilling tines go to, you're imposing compaction at that depth, and now you're going to have a huge problem, but all of the part of the soil that did all the fluffing and the mixing has so battered and beat up and torn and wiped out most of the good guy organisms in that soil. If you had any earthworms, they're long gone. Oof, you just ground them up, mushed them. You've turned them into a puree. All of your fungal hyphae are just sliced and diced, and most of them aren't going to be able to survive and start growing again. The good guy nematodes, just absolutely, they're gone. If any of them survived that kind of tillage, their attitude is, oh, my gosh, look at this big earthquake that happened. This isn't a safe place to live. I'm heading for the hills. You know, it's like the San Francisco earthquake just happened to them, and they're not sticking around. They're gone. So all of the good guys have headed for the hills, and really what's left behind is a boatload of bacteria, all of which are quite happily now growing in the conditions that's been left behind by that severe disturbance. And quite often those bacteria start growing so fast, they use up oxygen faster than oxygen can move into the soil, and you actually go anaerobic after a rototilling event. And so it depends on what's the tillage that you did. Is it really going to be more or less harmful than some other management practice that you did? What was the second question again, Hugo?
No, the type of tillage is light disking, usually on the surface, using disc plows.
Elaine, David's on the call. I will unmute and just see if we can get David to explain it. If it's too noisy, I'm just going to shut it down again. So just bear with me. David, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Did that
Helen?
Give you enough answer, or would you like to ask a further question, David?
Yeah, I'd just like to take it a little further, if I can, Dr. Ingham, in that I've been using practices starting in 1999, which correlates with you there, using either green manures and no chemical inputs, and only using either duck compost, which I've bought commercially, or duck manure, which has got a lot of wood shavings in it. And I'm using now a disc, an offset disc, to incorporate like the stubbles into the soil, and in the same time, you know, control the summer weeds which we have, and that. But I only do it after the topsoil is pretty much dried out, but the seed bed is still damp, and I also only go very slowly, and I use a tractor so that I minimise compaction. And so I'm interested in what you've said, you know, as regarding harming the soil, and trying to do as less damage as I can, but also trying to incorporate the stubbles from the previous crop.
Where do we start in this annual cycle? If you start with the stubble, and so you've gone in and harvested, and you've got the stubble, a great deal of it's laying down on the soil surface. You want to watch the decomposition of that material. If you've got good biology in the soil, those organisms will decompose and turn that stubble material into soil within about a month period of time. If you're seeing that the stubble is still sticking around longer than that, then you know that you've got to be improving the biology in the soil. You don't have what you need in the soil to do, you know, to turn all of that residue material into soil in the time period that you really want to see it happening. It also, if you don't have the biology in the soil to decompose that stubble material quite rapidly and turn it into soil, then that means you don't have the condition in the soil to select against the weedy species. So you're going to continue having weed problems. So you can, in some instances, you can just watch what's going on in your field and know whether you've got a problem, whether your biology needs to be fixed. So the fact that you've got now summer weeds coming up in the summertime says to me, you again, there's another message from Mother Nature saying you don't have this fixed yet. So just because you've been buying compost from somebody and been putting out manure that's got a lot of wood chips and things in it is not fixing the problem for you. You need to do a little bit more testing. You're going to have to do a little bit more effort to make certain that things are moving in the right direction. So in the fall, as soon as you're harvesting, why not be applying the proper biology. So a compost or a compost tea where you're specifically selecting for the organisms that are going to fix your problem. Probably a lack of fungi, probably don't have the protozoa, you probably don't have the good guy nematodes. So we need to see all of those in that compost, in the compost tea. And typically in the fall we want to put it on the residues so that they decompose as rapidly as possible, you know, in, at harvest time. They decompose as rapidly as possible and start turning into soil. And then all through the dormant period, through your cooler months, the winter months, all of those organisms will be working to build structure to get rid of the compaction. So could you be going out there once a month and documenting the compaction going away? You want to be really looking at compaction in your soil like once every other month, once a month, because there will be differences based on the moisture in your soil, what compaction zones you're actually going to pick up. The drier your soil, the more that compaction is going to be very, very obvious and what's affecting your root growth. So we want to be looking at that compaction. Is it being fixed with the biology or is it still there? Come springtime and you go out there and you can see a whole bunch of weeds starting to grow. Again, that's an indicator that you don't have the biology where in the proper balances. Because if it was fungal, slightly fungal dominated, or equal biomass of fungi to bacteria up above threshold levels, you wouldn't see those weed seeds germinate and start to grow. The seed bank might be there. The seed bank might be there, but if we get the biology right, those seeds won't germinate, they won't grow. And then on through the springtime period, you might want to be putting out compost teas to make sure certain that the biology is being maintained properly. You might even want to go in with whenever you are doing tillage to deal with whatever weeds are coming up. Every time you do that kind of tillage, be applying compost tea and maybe even injecting compost tea down deeper into the profile to wherever your compaction layer is, wherever that compaction layer is not being fixed. So that kind of gives you the seasonal cycle of how you want to be managing this. And of course, when it's working, there are no weeds. So, you know, you stop having to manage and keep disturbing your soil and stop setting the stage to grow more weeds.
Thank you very, very much for that. One further question, if I may. We've been in a drought situation here for the past decade with either below average rainfall or drought rainfall. And then I'm assuming that if I apply the right biology and so forth, it has to be done with moisture, and that otherwise it's not worth it. Is that correct?
I'm coming more and more to the opinion that is true. Now, there have been instances in the very arid western part of the United States where we've put on compost extract. The organisms weren't activated, so they weren't growing really rapidly. We were putting on mostly dormant organisms. And when that compost extract went out, there was absolutely no moisture in the soil. And those organisms seemed to just hang out and wait for moisture to finally happen. And so when rain finally fell, those organisms took off and started working right away. But if you're putting out a compost tea, see, it's not going to work. Because if the organisms are active and growing, they've got to be put into a habitat where they've got food, where they've got water, where they're not going to be instantly killed by going into the Sahara Desert. So, you know, you've got to kind of hedge your bets. What time of year do you have to be making tea, to make compost, and be putting it out? Can you manage putting out a compost tea in the springtime? Do your other chores, do the other management practices that you have to do allow you to have the time to put out the tea. If you don't, then you're going to have to put out extracts when you do have time and hope they'll come back to life when you finally do have some rainfall. But I'd say, yes, it's you really want to be applying this biology when you've got moisture of some kind. Even if the only time you can be applying it is in the morning when you've got a heavy dew, that works. That's all the more these organisms require. If you've got compaction right at the soil surface, if your soil is like concrete right there at the top, you're going to have to till. You've got to till those organisms into the soil under those conditions because you've got a salt layer at the surface of the soil, and that's what's causing surface compaction. That's what causes that concrete-like layer at the surface of the soil. And, of course, if you put on the organisms and basically what you're doing is dropping them into the Dead Sea, they don't survive. So under certain conditions, for the one last time, you'll till. Get that compaction layer at the surface of the soil broken up so that never happens again. Let's get the compaction broken up deeper down into the soil so that our roots can grow as deep as they can and you don't have to have as much moisture to grow your plants. If we can build structure so all of the water is held in your soil, we can grow the same amount of crop on 70% less water. And we've demonstrated that over and over again at this point, that we can reduce water use by up to 70%. Now, if you don't get all the biology right, if you don't get structure built properly well, then maybe only a 50% reduction in water or a 30% reduction in water use. But a lot of times we deal with growers that because they're retaining more water in the soil, what they're looking at is doubling or tripling their yields, using the same amount of water as they used to, but they've doubled or tripled their yields. So it's kind of up to you as a grower, how do you want to work this?
Hugo, there's another question here.
It's a phytophthora problem in peach and nectarine orchard south of Sydney. The question is, we have a peach and nectarine orchard and some of our trees are dying. We think it is phytophthora fungal disease. What is the best approach? Is there a short or a long-term solution? We have started applying some humic acid. That's the question.
Yeah, I'd really like to talk to that grower because I need to know the symptoms. What's leading them to think that it's a phytophthora problem? Precisely what symptoms are they looking at? If it's some fungus is taking out the leaves and, you know, attacking the fruit, if they're looking at mildew-like conditions on the leaves, well, the simplest way to deal with that is to make a really good compost tea and apply that compost tea, making certain that you're getting at least 70% coverage on the leaf surfaces. Now, if it's really a tephrina, usually and that's a peach leaf curl, not a phytophthora, it's a tephrina, it's a different fungus. Usually one application of compost tea, and you've wiped out tephrina for the next umpteen years, probably don't have to worry about it again. If it's really mildew, and that's the problem that's being dealt with, you're going to have to be applying the compost tea several times during that growing season, and you've got to wipe out the mildew wherever it's being harbored. There's some place in the vicinity where that fungus is growing and reproducing, and the spores are getting put back up into the air, and they're colonizing the leaf surfaces of the plant, causing constant reinfection of your plants with those mildew spores continuing the problem. You've got to go and find that place where the fungus is growing, and it's in your soil someplace. It's probably in an area where the leaf material is not decomposing. You've got residue material sitting on the surface of the soil. It could be under a row of weeds. It could be under some holly. It could be, you know, go looking for the place where you're seeing not decomposing plant material. And that's what it has to get dealt with. You've got to decompose that plant material. Every single year, when that dead leaf material blows into that area, you got to make sure to get under there and get that organic material to decompose. Otherwise, the Phytophthora just comes right back. It regrows, and you constantly have a problem. So the short-term fix for this situation is the instant you see the first evidence of the Phytophthora starting to grow, you get out there with a good compost tea and get those leaf surfaces covered. Pick some of the leaves off, send them into the laboratory to make certain that you're getting the leaf surface coverage 70% or more. And typically with Phytophthora, we have to have at least 5% of that leaf surface covered with really wide diameter fungi. So we got to have that in the compost, so we can extract it into the tea, and it's got to land on your leaf surfaces and glue itself on there right away. We want to see at least 60% of that leaf surface covered with bacteria and a huge diversity of bacteria. If you're getting a tea that you only see one or two bacterial species, it's just not going to do the trick. You've got to keep improving diversity so you're seeing rods, and you're seeing little cocci and big cocci and medium-sized cocci and modal cocci and not modal cocci, where you're seeing teeny tiny little rods, and you're seeing bigger, fatter rods and really long, fat rods and long, skinny rods, and all of those combinations of types of bacteria need to be in that compost, and they need to be covering your leaf surfaces. Typically, in that growing period where the Phytophthora is typically colonizing the leaf surfaces. And please realize that Phytophthora spores start landing at bud swell. So you got to put the first application of your compost tea on there to protect the buds. About a month later, you want to go in and put on another application to protect those, you know, the leaves as they're starting to grow out. A month later, as you're going through, you know, mature leaf materials, you know, where is blossoming occurring, you got to protect all of those surfaces. Then make sure during the same time that you're starting to go after wherever it is in your orchard floor that the Phytophthora is overwintering, that it's reinfecting, constantly reinfecting everything in your orchard. And that's got to get dealt with by applying compost extract, compost tea, composts. Really think about putting in an understory crop species that is a perennial plant that's got the same mycorrhizal fungi as your peaches or whatever orchard tree you're growing. Make certain that it's going to be a fungal-dominated plant. And most typically the plants we're talking about here are the perennial herbs. So go find your favorite perennial herb, like, basil, marjoram, majorum, however you want to pronounce that word. Lavender is a good one. In wet parts of the world, strawberry works. In dry parts of the world, you want to go find something more like a Wiltonia or a wintergreen, a very drought-tolerant, low-growing, thick crown so weeds don't come in. You won't ever have to weed underneath your trees again. Wouldn't that be wonderful? If you harvest by shaking the tree and dropping the nuts or dropping the fruit to the orchard floor and then sweeping them up, you want to make sure that you have a perennial herb where you can go and cut it right before you harvest. So you're sweeping up off of that very clean-cut stem material of your perennial plant. And then that plant starts to regrow as soon as you get some moisture in the fall or after harvest. And then that regrows, and so you get the coverage back again. Especially with orchard plants where as they get older, they are going to start giving you a canopy closure. You might want to seed in a second understory plant species that will tolerate very low light conditions. And so quite often you're starting to look at different kinds of ivies. You got to make sure you don't get a vining ivy that will grow up your trees. Lots of different kinds of perennial plants, and you probably really want to look for some native ones. Go talk to a botanist, preferably a native plant botanist, and ask them what kinds of plants have those characteristics. They grow really short. They produce nice thick crowns so weeds can't get in there. They are mycorrhizal. They don't spread much, but you can drive over them. All the characteristics I was just talking about.
That's great.
The next question is, thanks, Dr. Elaine Ingham. question is, liming of paddocks. The question is, can we put lime in our compost, create a lime with a compost, and at what rate would you put lime in a compost heap?
My attitude about this has been changing over the years. Because, probably 10, 15 years ago, we were looking at where does calcium come from in soil and where does the phosphorus to replace the plant material, the phosphorus that was in the plant material, when you harvest something and you cart it off, that's going off with a lot of nutrients. So where's the next increment of phosphorus coming from, or calcium or boron or whatever other plant nutrient? And, I was trying to figure that one out because, of course, when you look at an old-growth forest, there's lots of export of material out of an old-growth forest, not that much coming back in. And so there's this constant export out of that old-growth forest. The leaf litter falls in the stream, and it gets washed downstream, and it doesn't come back. The bears walk out of the forest and they poop out there and they don't necessarily go back to the same place. So what causes replenishment of the nutrients in those systems? Because clearly they're not hurting. Nobody's out there putting in organic fertilizers, and yet we get the greatest, most rapid rates of plant accumulation, tissue accumulation of, and it's got to have calcium and boron and zinc and iron, and all of those things have to be present because otherwise the plant couldn't grow tissue. So when I really started trying to figure this out, the experiments that we were doing, we finally realized that you have an infinity supply of calcium in your soil. You have a huge amount of phosphorus. You have an overwhelming amount of almost any nutrient you want to talk about in your soil. And if, perchance, we were taking a lot of that off with the crop, where's fresh, new mineral nutrient going to come from? And it comes from the bedrock. Every year, the microorganisms that are in your soil are chewing up the rock material and bringing into play more of the nutrients that were in the rock, that were in the sand, that were in the silt, in your clay colloids. If you've got organic matter in your soil, they're going to be taking the nutrients out of that organic matter and bringing them back into bacterial and fungal biomass, which, of course, then get eaten by protozoa, nematodes, microarthropods, earthworms, and that releases those mineral nutrients in plant-available forms right around the root system. So you need the transport by the protozoa, the nematodes, the microarthropods, the earthworms, into the root system of the plant. But there's a constant, never-ending replenishment. For as long as you've got sand, silt, and clay in your soil, why are we worried about calcium in your soil? Because as long as the biology is there and the biology is capable of solubilizing that calcium from the parent material, from your sand, silt, and clay, we don't really have to worry. As long as the biology is there, as long as your root systems are producing exudates to keep those organisms alive and functioning and breaking down the calcium that is in your parent material, I don't see any reason anymore to be putting lime into the compost or putting lime into your soil or anything else. Only if you don't have biology will you not have the calcium-magnesium ratio that you need to have. If the biology is properly balanced for the plant you're trying to grow, those microorganisms will balance the calcium-magnesium ratio, and it's going to be spot on. That's what we're seeing more and more and more as we're testing these things, where people are actually doing the chemistry testing as well as the biological testing. And what we find is if the biology is right, then the chemistry is right. If the biology is not right, then the chemistry is wrong. And then you get to play games. And as soon as you start putting on inorganic materials like lime, you kill the biology in the soil, and then you really put yourself into that situation where you're going to have to add inorganic fertilizers in order to grow your plants. But I invite people to go back and start, you know, read your Bibles and read where the Roman Empire goes in and conquers a nation that's trying to rebel, or a nation that the Roman Empire is trying to take over. And once the Roman Empire conquers that nation, what is it that the Roman Empire does to make sure that that nation will never, ever again be able to challenge the Roman Empire? And the Roman Empire would go in and salt their soil. And the salt that they used was not sodium chloride. That's a trade commodity. Salt, table salt, is like money in the Roman Empire. Little bags of weighed out salt, sodium chloride, was actually used in place of coin back in those days. So the Romans weren't taking the expensive stuff and putting that out on these soils to cause problems with a conquered nation. What they were putting out was gypsum and lime, and destroying the fertility of those soils by killing off the biology. And if you can't support your country with your agricultural produce, you become dependent. And we just don't need to be putting lime in things. So I've really changed my attitude about adding lime to anything. We have more than enough calcium in our soils. It's like in Australia, people have, you've been told probably your whole life that there's not enough phosphorus in soil. The phosphorus in Australian soils has been depleted, and that is absolutely not the case. You have beaucoup amounts of phosphorus in your soil. What you're lacking is phosphate. And the way you get the phosphorus out of your rock, out of your sandstone and clay, is to have the bacteria and fungi that solubilize that phosphorus, turn it into phosphate inside the bacteria and fungi, and then the bacteria and fungi get eaten by the protozoan, nematodes, arthropods, and mycorrhizal fungi, will take up and translocate that nutrient to your plant. So we don't need to be putting out phosphate fertilizers. We don't need to put out lime. You don't need to put out any mineral nutrient, as long as you've got the biology in your soil functioning, active, doing what it's supposed to do.
Thanks, Dr. Elaine Ingham. That's a very, very good answer, and I hope people, when they get this CD, that they listen to it two or three times, because it makes it very, very clear as to what you've been saying for a long time.
Great.
And farmers save a lot of money too when they get that message.
Yeah. Yeah, they can save a lot of money, and that's we got to get people off that chemical treadmill where if you succumb and you start putting these salts out, then you really set yourself in that condition where you have to continue using the salts until you put the biology back into your soil. But you've got to make sure you're getting the right balances of the whole food web.
Mm. Yes, I mean, you'd be interested, that's a society issue. They're saying we're going to run out of phosphate, so we've got a lot of problems facing us, and we're going to have to find other answers. They were saying in our farm journal last week, they're also saying that we're going to have to, with the drought, we're going to have to devise plants that have longer roots, because the roots aren't long enough, and this will solve all the problems. And I just thought, it's just...
it's like your roots already go down... The physiology of the plant puts, you know, if it could, it would go down you know, 3-4 meters. How much longer do you want to be? But it's the compaction that we're imposing on our soils by the tillage, by the use of driving across the, you know, huge herds where the biology can't recover from all of those hooves, golf courses where you've got all those people walking across the golf course and no resuscitation of the biology to build rebuild structure. That's what the real problem is. It's the compaction. It's not the fact that plants should have longer roots. They already have long enough roots.
We've
got to engineer. We've got to genetically engineer plants so they've got longer roots, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Doesn't it make you want to smack your forehead? Jeez.
I was going to write a long letter, and I thought, no.
Yeah, right. If anyone is that unknowledgeable of what plants do and what should be going on out in the soil, it's, you know, well, there's not much hope.
Now, Elaine, we do have 3 more questions, but we are very aware of your time, so it's up to you whether we go ahead with the questions or we call it a stop here.
Well, we could maybe go for 20 more minutes, and then I will have to call a stop to this.
Right. Okay. So one that I feel has been answered, but it's going to be a good one to answer once again, is how do we counter capeweed using compost tea and lime and reactive rock phosphate if necessary? Now, you've talked a lot about weeds before, so is there anything else you'd like to say about capeweed, perhaps?
Yeah, capeweed is a very early successional plant species. It typically requires compaction in the soil because it's got a pretty nice taproot to it, and it is Mother Nature's way of trying to break through that compaction. It's just unfortunately it takes too long and, you know, isn't supportive of our crop plants if we've got those weedy species in the system. So way too bacterial dominated. We don't have good nutrient cycling. Soil's compacted. It sets the stage for plants like capeweed. And it's just how do you put the biology back into the soil? Are you going to have to actually till it in because you may have to break a compaction layer at, you know, 15 centimeters, 20 centimeters, 30 centimeters. And it's really hard to get the biology down there unless you do one last tillage. Just make sure, you know, 2 weeks after you've added the proper biology, come back in and test the soil. Check the penetrometer. Make sure that the compaction is actually going away and not reforming. So, do a little bit of checking after you've put things in to make certain that you're actually seeing the benefits that you want to see. And that one last tillage, it should be the last time you have to till. Although, let me put a little caveat in here. We've dealt with some soils where residues in the soils have not decomposed. They've been, you know, it's like I'm here in Hawaii, for example, and in places where they were putting on really toxic chemicals for 100 years. They were burning the sugarcane. They were burning the plant material off, so, you know, there's no food left to have fed the organisms. We've got some severe compaction problems, and we've got all kinds of chemical residues left in these soils. For example, like dieldrin sometimes does not break down at all, and we're still finding dieldrin in soils, you know, 10, 20 years later, practically undecomposed in those soils because those soils have been so hammered. They're so anaerobic. There's no good life. So sometimes, even though somebody says, oh, you know, it's been 20 years since anybody used a pesticide here, if it hasn't decomposed, if it hasn't been chewed up by the biology, it's still there waiting to cause problems. So checking. When you put the biology in, you think it's working, check and make sure that it is working, that you're improving things that, you know, you're starting to develop the bacteria and fungi, protozoa, are getting more numerous. With your little microscopes, where you've got your own small microscope, you can be checking that. Because when you looked at it back before you did anything, you can see that there's not very many bacteria. There are no fungi at all. You're not finding any protozoa. So now you put the first application in, and you can see that, well, the bacteria have grown. Yeah, I don't have any fungi really growing yet, or protozoa, or nematodes, so I better keep working at this. And you keep putting on the next increment. You know, if you put on three applications of the really good biology and the organisms are still really not improving, that might be the time where you want to think about putting in a pretty good slug of molasses to let the bacteria start growing and chew up whatever toxic residue might be in that soil. And then you're going to have to come back in with that really good biology yet again and see if you can't get it established. So residues, toxic chemical residues, can be a real problem in these soils under some conditions that won't allow you to get going.
Okay, excellent. So it really keeps coming out, Elaine, check, 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 and observe. You know, it's a very clear message that you're giving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's great. The next question is, he is registered as an organic beef producer and would like to know how you would best get the best out of sorghum or millet direct drilled using disc and press wheel into existing irrigated pasture. Obviously, artificial nitrogen not to be used. His penetrometer readings are 500 and compost tea has been sprayed in early December with the help of Darren Morgan. An airway is available. So he's... Have you got that question clearly?
I hope so. You might have to remind me a few of the details if I seem to sort of forget them. So now he's got a pasture.
Sorry. He put 20 liters of good compost for the hectare.
Okay. The pasture was compacted. He's reading 500 pounds per square inch pressure at what depth?
Doesn't say.
So, but, you know, I'm...
And it's pretty compacted soil.
Very compacted. In general, when you're looking at root systems, they're going to start being slowed down. Most of our row crop vegetable grasses don't do very well once the soil gets to 150 pounds per square inch of pressure. They're having hard problems. Now, weeds, they don't care. They'll go right through that. But that's why Mother Nature sends those weeds in to try to deal with that compaction zone. It's just going to unfortunately take them a while, the weeds a while, to get rid of that problem. So we could speed it up. Now, when you hit 300 PSI, there are very few root systems on any plant that's going to be able to push their way through a soil that is compacted to 300 PSI. A few taproots might be able to push their way through. So if you've got, you know, we've talked about some of those plants that have pretty good taproots, they'll be able to push their way through that. But by the time you get up to 500 PSI, I don't know very many, other than some taproots that are going to push their way through something that's compacted up to 500 PSI. So whatever depth that was, that compaction was, when you're direct drilling, you might actually be able to punch that hole down to that compaction layer and hopefully even below. And so when you're doing direct drilling, why not, as that hole is being punched, the drill is punching that hole, pulling that little core out to drop seed into it, why not also be putting in a big pulse of really good compost tea with all the active organisms, make sure that that seed's completely coated with that really good compost tea, so that all the right biology are on the surface of the root of the seed and coating the side of your drill hole where you just dropped your seed in. And hopefully if you're getting below that compaction zone, below the 500 PSI layer, the microorganisms are going to grow out in every direction, and you're going to start dealing with that compaction problem from below as well as above. Because, the direct drill, you're punching a hole and you're putting in that really good biology, you know, every couple centimeters, every 10 centimeters, that, you know, depending on your seed spacing. So that would be the really fast way to start breaking up a tillage, a compaction problem, where you don't want to be tilling, you've got a system that you don't want to disturb the understory plant species, just be applying that compost tea straight down that direct seeded hole. Make sure that it's on, all the right biology is on the seed. If the soil is such where the hole stays open, you might even be able to, right after that, refill that little hole with some really good compost mixed with a little bit of sand so it goes right down that hole. A lot of soils are, you know, really have some structure, and so you punch the hole, pull your drill out, and the hole itself just collapses right down and kind of covers up your seed. Well, that's fine. Maybe you could be given a little squirt of good compost tea to the surface of the soil once that drilled hole starts closing in again. Give it one more shot of really good biology so you're enhancing the growth of the crop species that you're trying to establish there. Does that make sense? Did that kind of answer all of the question?
That's excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Elaine, I think we'll just move on to complete this call now because I'm very keen that people get a sense of where you see they should be starting. Now, we're talking mainly to people on this call who are not your students at this point. They are looking to change, and they're really very, very keen to get their soils going and choosing all sorts of different ways and things like that. I'm putting you on the spot here, but if one of these farmers came to you and said, I'd like to change, I want to get my soil going, where do I start?
The first step that they would probably want to do would be to contact the lab in Lismore and let Merlene talk with them about what is their situation. What are the problems that they've got? What are they trying to grow? Can we reasonably help them? And I like to set up programs with them so that if I have that background information, Merlene and I typically talk that over, and we set up a course of action where, you know, given the plant you want to grow, given the diseases, the weeds, all of the problems that you're listing for us, if you follow this set of instructions, most of the time it works. We get pretty, you know, intense on the, you got to test that compost so we know that you've got the biology. You've got to test the tea. We want to know your sprayer is okay. We want to know if you're out there spreading the compost. We want to know what hits the soil 2 weeks later, what's actually survived. So especially with people who are just getting started, they really might want to reduce their costs a little bit by getting a small microscope themselves or finding a neighbor that is doing this for the area. And I know down around Melbourne we've got a number of people that are doing small microscopes. There's a laboratory just outside of Melbourne where they're getting going on doing these small-scale assessments for growers. And talk to Merlene. She would know. The head of the lab, the SFI lab in Lismore, would be the person to talk to about that. And do these qualitative assessments of your compost, of your teas, your soil 2 weeks later, 2 weeks after you've done something. If you till, make sure that you've tested the soil before you till, and then 2 weeks later, look at your soil and see if that tillage event did any damage to the biology. And if damage was done, then you know what you've got to get put back in there with your next application of compost or compost extract or compost tea. And so we just put together a year-long program for you, and we will attempt to placate you and remind you that we need to see this data coming in. We need to see the compost and the teas and the two-week assessment. If you stay on the program, we can pretty much guarantee that you're going to be successful. But if we're trying to work with you and we don't get the data back, we don't get any assessments of the compost or the teas, or, well, then it's not our problem. The course of action wasn't followed. We can't guarantee results at all.
That's very clear. And apart from that, Of course, we've got your two-day courses on true soil fertility, which really gets people to understand what's going on in their soil. And we also have your two-day compost tea course. We have two excellent revision days as well, which for me, coming from very little understanding of this whole world of microbes and hearing you, you're very, very easy to listen to. You're a great teacher. And they would be another area that I'd suggest any farmer, any grower start with, just to understand what they're doing with when they're using the soil and growing.
Exactly. And I think it's been working with you, and you're helping me understand where it is that people who don't have extensive years and years of microbiological training, I've got to state things in a way that are clear for your typical grower, because they don't have the years of training. It's got to be said in a language that's more understandable to the general public. So I think it's really helped to have you working with me on these. So these, the recordings that you've got, I think are quite useful by your typical grower.
I think they're great, and hopefully we can get a few online courses going with you, Elaine, where people can, you know, have a small dose of understanding something, and then they can talk to you, and we can do an online training course, which I'd really look forward to doing, and I know you're interested, and we could reach very quickly a lot more people. So
yeah,
anyone listening,
great if we could, like a couple of guinea pig growers where they were willing to do the program, and we could, like, every 3 months have, you know, an overview of what's happened in the last 3 months, what did they have to do, how well did it work, you know, what did their qualitative assessments actually look like, how rapidly has everything improved, you know, just kind of have some real examples, a demonstration, couple of growers.
Yes, so if someone's online and is interested in this opportunity and are listening to the CD later, please email into us. And also, if you are interested in online learning course with Elaine, we could run a pilot one of those too, Elaine, you know.
Yeah.
And just find out how well it goes. So, Elaine, I really have to thank you so much for all the work you're doing and your absolute dedication to the future of this planet. And thank you very, very much for your time. I know you're in Honolulu, the home of the Pup the Magic Dragon at the moment.
That's right. I would have been out surfing. No, I would have been in the laboratory here staring through the microscope. So we're working with a farm operation here, so bringing them online with the microscopes and getting them moving in the right direction is a pretty
good thing. It's great, because we were in Hawaii a couple of years ago, and that's the area where there's a lot of organic growing and awareness, isn't there?
Yeah, a lot of organic folks, a lot of interest in food quality. And so we need to, you know, instead of looking at organic produce that looks really bad and I don't think I want to eat it, I want to get that organic produce looking beautiful, you know, things that are just too good looking to pass up. So, of course, you want to buy them and eat them.
That's the thing. That whole other discussion is the nutrient mineral dense quality of the food, which your compost teas are going to assure are released for the plant to take up, and other forms of organic farming might not necessarily do that.
Right, just because you follow some traditional process doesn't mean you're assured that the biology is getting back into the soil. And really, we've shown for a number of years in the organic world that the people who are really successful are the ones who have, by hook or crook or just luck, gotten the biology back pretty well balanced in their soils. The ones who really aren't successful, they don't make the grade. They're the ones that are, you know, through maybe no fault of their own or through a lack of understanding, they are harming their biology time and time again. And, you know, it's just in the organic world, we are allowed to use copper. Well, that's a pesticide, and it kills your fungi. We're allowed to use sulfur, and any sulfur compound, inorganic sulfur compound, is typically the basis of most antifungal antibiotics. And so basically when you're putting on a sulfur compound, you're knocking your fungi off. So you look at Bordeaux mix. Well, it does a great job of killing fungi, but you're killing the good guys and the bad guys. So even in the organic world, we've been allowed, because of tradition, we've been allowed to put out pesticides. If you're truly organic, you don't need those things. But when we're dealing with a lot of people who are organic by substitution and not by reality, a lot of supposedly organic food is really not much better than the inorganic chemical food that we eat a great deal of the time.
Mm. Well, as far as providing nutrition, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Elaine, back to your surfing.
Okay, because it's just a, you know, late afternoon here, so those waves are waiting.
Ooh, well, go and enjoy them, refresh yourself, and I'd like to thank you, and I'd like to thank everyone who's listened to this call, and really urge you to get going, to get that soil really working for you, and so you can, you know, have time to surf.
Yeah, and thank you very much, Helen and Hugo, for taking the time to put all this together. This is quite some effort on your part, too, that to organize all of this, and it's great that you're doing it.
Thanks, Elaine, and thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.